So you poured a glass of wine for us. Let's just start with that.
Sure, we'll jump right in. This is Jose Pariente Sauvignon Blanc from Rueda, Spain, 2017 vintage. Cool thing about this wine and this winery is we're looking at the third generation of the Pariente family. Verdejo is the primary grape in Rueda. The Sauvignon Blanc here makes up a smaller percentage of acreage.
I didn't even realize that they did a varietal Sauvignon Blanc bottling in Rueda.
They sure do.
Is this a common thing, or how long have they been growing Sauvignon Blanc in Spain? This is a common thing?
It is a little bit in Rueda across the regions of Spain. When they're penetrating a new market, everyone does Sauvignon Blanc. So they want to focus on what makes them different, what they do that no one else is doing. You know, if they were to start in America with, hey, here's our Sauvignon Blanc, our reception would probably be something
like,
yeah, we have those. Yeah, we have those.
What else you got?
So even in the glass, like this kind of stands apart from a lot of Sauvignon Blancs that I'm familiar with. It seems more floral. It seems less cutting.
Would it be a mistake to say this is less acidic than other Sauvignon Blancs?
I would say less noticeable acidity. You know, it's very well integrated. It's clean and it's crisp and it's fresh, but you're not getting a lot of that tingle, that kind of tangy feeling sensation that's in the bottom of your jaw that is sometimes associated with a sourness.
Yeah, like mouth-watering quality. Yeah.
I don't know how else to describe it. It's not as sharp. Like Greg kind of said, it's soft and it's round. I don't want to call it flabby, but it just, the mouthfeel alone doesn't feel like a Sauvignon Blanc I've had before.
It's definitely more tame and kind of restrained in style. I think fashioned a little more after a French style, not as round and lush and ripe. So the acidity is there, but like John said, you're not perceiving it as fiercely.
Kind of a middle ground. While it is leaner than New Zealand, it's not as lean and not as mineral driven as we would see in France. And I think a lot of that is we do have very warm, sunny days, long sun in the growing season, but overall a continental climate. When I showed up, my first day was about 60, 70 degrees out there. It was awesome. It was a beautiful Saturday to just be walking around. But my last day was down to 28. So we do see that full shift in temperature.
If it isn't clear, today we're talking about Spanish wine, specifically of Rueda and Ribera del Duero. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Barrel to Bottle, the Binny's podcast. I'm Greg Versch. I do communications at Binny's. In the room with me today is Barb Stebbin.
Hey, I'm Barb. I do wine sales.
And Pat.
I'm Pat Brophy. I do spirits stuff.
And joining us today, fresh off his trip to sunny Spain, is
John Adam, wine manager at the Oakbrook Binny's.
What Spain is to me, I sat next to the Spanish wine buyer for a while, and when I was a wine consultant, I thought, Spain is as old school as it gets, right? Like growing up, I had Ferdinand as the book, you know, the kid's book. Now it's some chintzy Disney movie, but, and everything in the book is so like dusty and old and, you know, old world. But that's not the only thing that's happening in Spain right now.
For sure.
And it's being led by these regions like Ribera del Duero and Rueda.
Definitely. You know, we look at these regions and they are only about 40 years old. Rueda being set up in 1980 and Ribera del Duero in 82.
I mean, I assume the winemaking tradition in these areas goes back many years, or is this something where they kind of recently they've kind of figured out that this would be also a good climate for what we're doing over there in Spain?
Definitely been around a while. They say that Verdejo has been cultivated in Rueda for about 1,000 years.
Wow.
A lot of the vineyards that we went through are 100 plus years old, which was really one of the most remarkable things I remember seeing. Stepping out into one of our first vineyard stop and seeing these old, gnarled vines that I always had associated with Syrah, Mourvedre, Grenache. You look at it and it looks like you would be pulling out red fruit, and these are Verdejo vines. A lot of the vine age is 30 to 40 years old, so there is a cyclical replanting going on to maintain style freshness, but there are a fair amount of vineyards that really do prize these older vines. One producer, they don't have the exact date of how old their vines are. The first record that they have is that the current owner's great-grandfather inherited these vineyards 170 years ago. And at that time, these same vines that are there today that they're using we're producing usable quality fruit.
What's the elevation there?
You will drive through the clouds to get there. What, you know, most people will fly into Madrid, and then as you're going out towards Burgos to get to this region, we're about 600 to 800 meters, really 2,000 to 2,500 feet. And on the right day, you will drive through the clouds.
That's amazing.
It's beautiful.
So, John, just to give people an idea geographically, you say you fly into Madrid, and then when we're going toward Rueda, what part of Spain is that in?
It's almost a straight shot north of Madrid, about 2 to 2.5 hours.
In Rueda, as a region, what's the most prominent grape? What should the wine noob expect out of this region?
Without a doubt, it's Verdejo. Verdejo counts for about 87% of the planted vines.
Wow.
The rest would be a little bit of Sauvignon Blanc, Palomino Fino. And there is a little bit of red wine production, which is only added to the DO.
Palomino Fino, like, is it still white?
Used for fortified wines, and I believe in a little bit in blends.
How about that? So you brought a Verdejo. Can we try it?
We brought two Verdejos. And yes, let's try them.
My question then, John, is why is a region that's good for Verdejo also good for Sauvignon Blanc, the continentality?
Climate definitely plays into it. Soil types as well. The soils here are very sandy. Not to jump away from your question, but getting back to the age of the vine, the very sandy soils prevented phylloxera from ever getting into the soils here.
That's cool.
However, John, in the DO Rueda, can we call it that if it's made with Sauvignon Blanc, or must it be made with Verdejo?
So any wine in Rueda that is going to be labeled as a varietal needs to be 85%. They are allowed to blend as well. If you get lower than 85% of the varietal, it can just be labeled as Rueda, which would still have to be at least 50% Verdejo.
So literally the DO is identifying by that.
Yeah, hitching your cart to that wagon. Yeah.
Wait, that's not right. On the back of the label, there's a much more precise identification of, you know, this is Verdejo and what that means. This is Sauvignon and what that means.
That's good for silly consumers like me who don't have the time to parse and break it down.
Let's talk about how this wine smells different than the first wine we passed around, right? So we had a Sauvignon Blanc, now we've got a Verdejo. Do you have anything in particular that jumps out at you?
I was going to say banana on the last one, and this is like way more amped up with that like fleshy, ripe banana quality on the nose.
Yeah, I get a little more peachy and kind of tropical, a little bit of grapefruit, less of that intense lemony lime citrus, but I get more aromatic, just kind of a little more expressive in general.
It's definitely not as floral as that first one. That Sauvignon Blanc had this floral quality, and I got a little like melon out of it, and this one is more, I don't know, it's fruity, but it's in a different fruity, and I'm having trouble pinning it down.
So it's like $15 for the Perianthe Sauvignon Blanc. What do you think this Verdejo costs?
I would probably around the same, $12 to $15, I would guess.
Nailed it. It's like 12 bones.
$11.99 for the Naya 2017 Verdejo.
I think it's really interesting on the palate, the texture of it. It's like steely and grained and almost tannic in a way that white wine often doesn't grip your palate that way.
Wow, you guys are doing awesome. I couldn't have written that better. I wanted to show both expressions because in doing blind tastings with friends, I think it's really easy to mistake Sauvignon for Verdejo and Verdejo for Sauvignon. But putting them side by side, it really shows the citrusy side of the Sauvignon and then the white fruits that we see in Verdejo. The big signature I saw after tasting Verdejo all day, every day, for days, was the varietal thing that rings true every time is there's almost a little bit of like a fennel character on the end of the finish. And there's a real clean kind of bitter pop at the end.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what really makes Verdejo itself and adds just an infinite versatility when pairing with foods and really mass appeal too. Like, can you think of a food that this won't work with?
Chocolate cake.
Like cheese, like pizza. This is a white wine that would go with a lot of heartier foods that you usually associate with red wine.
This is a good wine. This is interesting. Now, you had briefly touched on earlier about, you know, value in Spanish wine. And that's kind of, when I think Spanish wine, I generally think like, oh, probably get a decent wine for less than $10. I mean, is that the case with these now? Or have, I mean, I know Spanish wine has been growing in like the various industry rags and stuff you read. You know, Spanish wine has been growing pretty much globally, right? And it's been continuing to grow in our stores
about
as well.
A dozen year span, I'd say, is sort of a growing, maybe a plateau over the last year or two. But I think whites and sparkling wines especially are still growing. Yeah.
Now, with the growth of that category, I mean, we're still getting great value in it, though, right?
Absolutely. This Jose Pariente Sauvignon Blanc that we tasted, that would be on our shelf at $14.99.
Oh, not bad.
Which I think offers a lot of bang for the buck.
You spend the same amount on some, you know, giantly mass-produced
Big name Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand, we won't mention.
Yeah, and this is far more interesting. Yeah. It's the same price.
I think that's a good word in general to explain, especially white wines from this region, is just interesting and complex. To your point about Sauvignon Blanc earlier, that it's usually really high in acidity and piercing and this racing, vibrant Verdejo, and especially to John's point, depending on how it's treated, which I think we're going to see later.
Are we ever?
is a little bit tamer. And while it has the acidity of Sauvignon Blanc, it also has, yeah, that bitterness, the herbaceousness. It's not as one note frequently. So Spain in general offers value, and it offers a lot more just uniqueness across the board from one region to another. And north and north central Spain, I think a lot of us would argue, is especially true. And this has really been a standard on shelves for a number of years now, right, John? Like Bodegas Naya, it's there. A lot of folks keep it cold for instant purchase in the summertime especially. It's kind of a no-brainer.
You want to try the last Rueda here?
Holy Lord, I do.
So this is labeled Rueda, right? So we know it's 50%+.
This is also labeled as Verdejo, and this also comes from Bodegas Naya. This is what they at Naya call Nayades, the 2012 vintage, and I chose this wine for many, many reasons. The first off being, current release of this wine is 2016. We are tasting 2012.
When I first smelled this, it almost smelled beer-like to me.
Oh, really?
I don't
really
know if it's just like a citrus thing that I'm so ingrained and associated with hops or something. This was
might be some weird kind of innocuous yeast.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Almost like a, it almost like a smelled like Heineken. Like a hoppy Belgian beer. Like it smelled more like an old world beer. I mean, not so much anymore.
It's
but
a bit
interesting.
Like that popcorn quality and like a nuttiness, like a selenic nutty quality.
Interesting, you say nutty. What's that usually an indicator of, Greg?
Oxidized wine.
Not oxidized wine. Oxidative?
Oxidative.
Perhaps, yeah. Oxidized, generally not good. Oxidative can be good, right?
So what, it's that, so what, age? Like typical of age or typical of a production style?
A little of both, right, John? You want to talk to that?
Bingo, Greg.
By asking a question, he got the question right.
So this is the older vines from the same estate. We are looking at about 100-year-old vines. Showing that these wines, when we're looking at barrel-fermented and higher-quality vines, these wines can not only last, but improve with age.
This is really interesting.
This tastes stronger, too. Is this a higher alcohol percentage on this?
I don't
think
so.
The Nayades is 13.5.
I'd guess it's exactly the same.
Equal.
The same.
When you say taste stronger, Pat, what do you mean by that? Like, where are you getting it?
There was a more noticeable presence of ethyl alcohol.
So you want to talk about who would like these wines? The Sauvignon Blanc and the first Verdejo that you tasted us, the freshness, you could definitely say somebody who likes that, like, Sauvignon Blanc, possibly Pinot Grigio style. This seems a lot closer to a Chardonnay drinker.
Bingo.
Boom.
And bordering on somebody who's sherry curious.
Not only for the Chardonnay drinker, but when this wine first hit the market, this was a lot of people, importers, Somms, everyone was comparing this to white Burgundy. You know, you've got some barrel fermentation, you've got concentration of fruit,
yeah,
you've got, you know, power and acid playing together.
Yeah.
And this
and the classiness of like tertiary age qualities that let me
especially
say that
on the finish.
On the finish?
On the finish for sure. And I think that fennel really kind of resonates on the end, showing the varietal signature.
Yeah. And so this is labeled as a Verdejo, so it's at least 85%, you said?
Correct. Yeah, so it has to be at least 85%. Honestly, when someone labels as Verdejo in this region, it usually is 100%.
Okay.
You don't want to guess at the price on this one?
This is a high-quality white wine with all those awesome characteristics like you alluded to, like white Burgundy and Chardonnay-like. I mean, taste alone, I would assume this costs about $40.
Yeah, and side-by-side, if you're talking about some of the white Burgundies in those regions, I'd specifically compare it to in Chasson Montrachet or Poulany Montrachet, you're talking about low 40s into maybe $60. So that's a fair comparison, and I think it does stand up to its neighbors in that regard, but you are incorrect, my friend.
John Tom.
25 fat ones.
Wow. Yeah. This is a great wine for $25.
World class.
I'm really impressed.
I always like to treat myself to a bottle of this every summer. One day when I know that I'm off during the week and I give myself like a late lunch, early dinner out on the patio. Just
take one to the dome.
Take the bottle, big old bowl of chips, guac,
this bottle of this. Me time.
This is my me time.
Well, this is a great bottle of wine. I can't believe it's only $25.
Yeah, I mean, to speak to some of the characteristics, we talked about like the mouthfeel and the texture's lovely. There's a lot of finesse. It's somehow toasty but not oaky, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely.
Like, the creaminess, the lithe texture is there, but this flavor profile is so unique. I agree. I love this in the spring and summertime, and I do it with a piece of meatier fish.
It would also be good with macaroni and cheese.
I agree with that.
Chorizo, mac, and
cheese.
Could
really go for some of that right now.
I like the idea of chips or chips and guac, though, too, because that acidity would...
Salty and...
Yeah, that's banging.
You can play with the spice. This wine's all about integration and balance.
Is this is a wine that we like regularly have in stock, or is this something... I mean, this is 2012, so I mean, they release a vintage of this every year, I assume. We just kind of... Only it trickles in, or?
You know, barrel fermentation does take time. I think current release that's going to be hitting the market this year will be 2016. So 12 is a little bit behind, but really not all that far.
So for someone who may be listening to this and thinking, okay, that's a cool bottle of $25, what is the big difference they're going to see in a 2016 bottle versus this 2012 bottle?
Great question. And we actually did that at the winery. We had the 2016 and the 2011. The 2016 comes off much more energetic. The acidity is brighter and a little more tingly, but still fades and integrates with the body very nicely. Fruit won't be as developed. You know, you'll get that fresher, a bit less nutty, maybe more barrel spice as opposed to the nutty characters from oak. Awesome at any age. I had a 2008 not long ago, and even that was just screaming good. Very, very rich.
I've had very little aged white wines like that before, so this is all new to me.
It's definitely a fun experiment to taste them, side by side, or a fresh release and something like this with even just a few years of bottle age. And to speak to the availability, this is the kind of wine that we wine nerds love to talk about and get behind, and we'll buy it for ourselves for late lunch on our patio. It is probably limited in terms of availability on shelves at all of our stores, but likely an item that would be available for special order anywhere.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
So, John, we talk a lot about old vines when we're talking about quality of wine. What's the difference between grapes produced from older vines versus grapes produced from vines that are only 5 or 6 or 10 years old? How does it impact the quality of the grapes, and therefore, what character does it impart to the final wine?
Regardless of age, a healthy vine is going to draw its nutrients from the soil. An older vine puts out less fruit. So, it's spending more time producing less. So that which does end up on the vine really shows the concentration of the vine's work in a smaller picture.
Awesome.
Really cool.
Hey, you want to switch gears and talk about red wine? So how far is Ribera del Duero from Rueda?
Not far at all. Yeah. They're neighbors.
Okay. So a 2.5-hour drive from Madrid, but you'd hang a right?
Pretty much. I think Ribera is a great place to start people in Spanish wine. You know, we sell so much Cabernet, specifically from California, not to discredit or underappreciate our Bordeaux drinkers, but when people are looking at coming in to try some Spanish wine for the first time, you know, I'll often ask them, what do they normally drink? Cabernet is frequently the answer. Depending on what kind of style, if they're looking for a more old world Cabernet, I usually will take them to Rioja. But if they prefer California or someone who's doing something more modern with Cabernet, I think Ribera can really offer a similar experience texturally. So many people are coming in saying when they describe what they want in a wine, it's more about texture than about flavor a lot of the time. And so when people are saying, I want a smooth cab, you know, these wines from Ribera are often much more plush and round.
That makes it an easy recommendation.
Yeah, I like that notion that a lot of customers and a lot of newer wine drinkers frequently, I agree, John, frequently they're not saying, I'd like a wine that tastes like blackcurrant and vanilla and lead pencil. They're saying, I want smooth. I want, so steering them towards a different region like this that's going to provide that experience is, that's the bread and butter for us wine nerds in the business.
I think it could be fun to do a tasting of like Rioja Reserva next to Ribera Reserva. And, you know, just really focus on the textural experience and down the line into, you know, Crianza as well.
And throw some French wines in there for mouse feel.
Yes. Feel that mouse.
This is interesting stuff. Celeste Crianza? Crianza? Crianza?
Crianza.
2015.
Whatever melts your butter.
Whatever stirs your Kool-Aid.
What's a Crianza? Is that a grape or a style?
Aging duration?
Absolutely. Age statements. In Ribera, we're looking at a few different styles. Hoven or Robel being less than a year of aging before release. The Crianza gets a minimum of 2 years age at the winery.
And this is age in bottle or age in oak?
Both.
Okay.
A Crianza must be at least 12 months in oak. The winery can choose to do combination. It could be 2 years in
two
oak.
It has to be at least 2 years total, and at least one of those has to be in oak.
Correct.
Okay.
Moving after Crianza, we have Reserva, which is a minimum of 3 years aging, with 12 months again in oak. From there, you jump up to Gran Reserva. Gran Reserva is 5 years age,
wow,
with a minimum of 24 months in oak.
So those words appear on other bottles in other regions. Like Rioja, is that the same, or is it different restrictions?
They're actually different aging requirements. So if you want to memorize all of it, you have to memorize two separate sets of Crianza, Reserva, Gran Reserva. However, the principle is the same,
yeah,
which is we release our wines when we feel they're ready to be consumed.
Like aged to maturity.
Correct.
As opposed to cellar.
Yeah. Oh, so this, yeah, is you take this home and drink it. You don't, yeah, stick it in the basement.
Right.
So it's already like been aged to perfection, yeah.
And that's not to say they can't continue to age. Is something we'll taste that I brought from my own personal stash that I've been holding on to for a handful of years. But a lot of producers also do choose to go longer. One of the wineries we were at in Ribera decided to hold back their 2010, but do a simultaneous release of their 09 and their 2011 because it was just their time.
Hmm.
So in both major regions for red wine production in Spain, they have these pretty serious aging requirements. But similar to regions in Italy, a lot of people are kind of getting away from that. We're going to talk about blending tradition with innovation. And one of the ways is to get away from some of these aging requirements because it just simply isn't a statement of quality. You can say we're aging our wines at least 5 years and still produce a wine that isn't very good.
That's fair enough.
But
you could take a wine and put it in barrel for 2 years,
mm-hmm,
stored in bottle for 6 years, mm-hmm, and legally release it as Gran Reserva.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, at $45 a bottle.
So that's like a new guard of producers who are like bucking the restrictions and creating something outside the bounds. Is that what you're saying?
There's some of that, yeah.
I was going to make a joke about with the different versions of age statements that Spain is taking it to Italy to be confusing. Like
it really is. If you study those side by side and then you look at Barolo with Brunello di Montalcino, it's mind-blowing how different all the age statements, yeah, can be. But, I mean, it's a good rule of thumb. It's like 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. And the older the wine, the better the wine, right? But that's not always necessarily true.
The older the wine, the more expensive the wine, traditionally.
Traditionally, yeah. But I think the important thing about age restrictions and age limits that John will probably speak to is the style that it suggests on a label. So Hoven means young and youthful and bright and vibrant, and Crianza means another thing, and Reserva means it's going to drink another way, and Gran Reserva means it's going to drink yet another way.
Hmm. I was going to say it would be a lot more simple if they just used numbers to signify age. But numbers don't speak to the style generally either, though, because that's just...
You're right. You're right.
It doesn't at all.
And that, you know, that like in whiskey, people can get infatuated with a number mm-hmm. when maybe the number isn't what they want. Maybe you want the 7-year bourbon instead of the 21-year bourbon. Can we try
this? So this is a Crianza.
This is a Crianza.
2015 Celeste Crianza.
By Torres Winery. Just like in Rueda, we see minimum varietal composition in Ribera as well, being 85% Tempranillo, them using the clone Tinto Fino.
Is that Tinto Fino something that would be varietally labeled, or would it just say
Tempranillo?
Like this says Tempranillo.
You just have to know it's...
We see a little bit of both. Clone?
Okay.
More commonly Tempranillo, because that is the, you know, it's...
It's what people know.
Yeah, just, I mean, even...
It's what people know.
Wine right. idiots like me know Tempranillo, but I've never heard of... Tinto Fino.
You mean that Tempranillo?
Tempranillo. That tastes like sarsaparilla, right?
This is a tannic beast, and it is young, and it is rough.
Is it? I haven't gotten there yet. I'm jumping in.
Tannic beast. Or maybe it's that it has medium tannins and less fruit to not support the tannins, but it is grainy.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I'd say it's a little out of balance today. Yep.
Thanks a lot, John.
The fruit's way down in the mix, and it's like the herbal pop, the... Like kind of a fennel, but it's like savory, dry tea leaf quality that's kind of taken over. Cola, maybe if you're going to be.
Really common descriptor for Tempranillo, black cherry and cola. And on the nose, I get both of those, but I agree that on the palate, it's coming off with a lot of skin tannin. That's all over my teeth. And it's a little disjointed, and then the finish just kind of falls a little flat for me today.
This never happens.
What is this crap you
brought
us? This
never happens on our podcast that we are like kind of disappointed by something. What do you have to say for yourself?
I'm really sorry, guys. I went to public school.
Yeah. So is this like indicative of the style? Like, is that like more severe structure, like what we would expect from something like this?
This definitely comes off more structured and, you know, more prickly tannin. I don't know if maybe it's not a fruit day. Is what a lot of people claim.
Can we try the next wine as we talk?
We can try the next wine. Protos 2012 Reserva.
You gonna try the Protos?
Yeah, this something... one smells riper and fruitier and kind of cherry, and this is interesting.
Well, coincidentally, it also received more age.
It's also a lot of like leathery... Ooh. Tone on the nose, a little bit more.
Now we're back in the game.
Oak presence. Yeah. A lot more expressive, kind of pretty floral notes.
I associate these notes with classy wine, like world class, historical, and the money that has to go into the wood.
Gosh, this is an interesting color. It's almost got a tinge of brown in it.
We are looking at 2012 versus 2015. That time in barrel will help for some oxidation.
Yeah, I find it much juicier on the palate. Mm-hmm. Forward, kind of a.
It's a pretty kick-ass wine. What does this cost?
About $35.
Big thing I get right on the nose is like leathery mm-hmm. licorice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I could just
sour cherry.
Mm. I hope this makes up for the other one.
I like leathery licorice. I like it as a vocal warm-up, too. We can use that from now on. Say it 4 times fast.
Leathery licorice.
Leathery licorice. Leathery licorice.
Man, is that bracing, too.
Yeah.
Wow.
So now we're seeing all the structure and kind of skin tannin presence that we've had in the last one, but we're also getting the acidity, the lift on the finish, the fruits there. I do love that leathery component mid palate. But for me, this is signature Tempranillo, especially in this kind of stage of its life. I want to think that if you just put it in a glass and hand it to me, I'd be like, yeah, that's definitely like middle-aged Tempranillo, cherry cola, little bit of that kind of sassafras root beer quality for me, and signature kind of leathery component. I love it. I think this is delicious.
I would swing and miss. I would stupidly guess Barolo on this.
Really?
Yeah, because I'm an idiot.
That's not brown enough for Barolo.
Mm.
I might think
it has like a much riper fruit core than Barolo does traditionally, like richer. But
a thing.
I'd probably guess some Italian wine.
Your Barolo fan would go for it, though.
I could definitely see an Italian drinker getting into this, you know, kind of that era, especially on the aromatics. Yeah. Like, this could be someone that's into Barolo or even Brunello.
I'm thinking, yeah, Sangiovese, that floral note especially. There's a lot of violet there, which I don't usually get from Tempranillo, but I think it's lovely. And still, I think a little bit of more time in the bottle would help this evolve, yes?
Absolutely. Tempranillo is one of those great grape varieties that can age for decades in the bottle. I always caution wine drinkers that once you do open a bottle of mature Tempranillo, and I'm talking something 15, 20 plus years old, drink it that night. I've made the mistake of, you know, opening an older, you know, like a 94 Gran Reserva Ribera, and being so excited about it, I save a quarter of the bottle to bring to work to show the guys, and it's completely dead. And it's like, whoa, 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 where'd you go? You were doing so much. Any other wine would have lived into the next day, but, you know, those older Tempranillos, drink them. Don't share them. If there's any kind of life-changing wine you can hope to come into contact with, I would definitely say Vega Sicilia should be at the top. We are tasting Vega Sicilia 2009 Valbuena 5 degrees, and 5 degrees refers to the 5 years that it ages. So really, you know, that's Gran Reserva to start. From there, they go up into their Unico, which is a minimum of 10 years.
Whoa.
Beyond that, Unico Reserva, which is a minimum of 14 years. And they do that just because that's what they do. This is also the winery responsible for the 85% requirement of Tempranillo. Not that they said they wanted 85%, but this is the property. They've been around since 1864, making Tempranillo in this region blended with the Bordeaux varieties. So we have them to thank for fun wines like this that they're making and that other producers are making that include Cabernet or Merlot or Petit Verdot. Anyone getting this glass yet?
Oh, it's so spicy. It's so baking spice.
My first impression is this huge, like, savory note that I didn't get out of the first two red wines we passed around. So it's a bit of a gear shift for me, which indicates age, firstly, but also just a very different style. When I say savory, I mean I'm getting some of that kind of soy teriyaki, umami, a little mushroomy, but there's also this awesome layer of, like, almost a baked cherry. Really, really beautiful. Just, I could just smell it for hours.
And it's grippy on the palate, kind of like the others, but in a much more graceful way.
Graceful is the perfect word for that. I love that.
I think if you're talking Ribera del Duero, you can't talk about it and not mention Vega Sicilia. And thank you, John. This is a really special treat. It's not something we get to taste often. It's kind of like talking about Napa Valley wine and not mentioning Robert Mondavi somewhere in the history of it. This is the one this is kind of the unicorn wine that everybody should get to try at some point or another.
Going through all these wines and talking about how their values, this is $1.50.
Yeah. Valbuena, depending on the vintage, I've seen them range anywhere from 120 to about 200.
Yeah.
And a lot of that goes into production and vintage quality. But, you know, they're also one of these guys that do it right and let the wine be what it's supposed to be. So if it's not ready, they're not going to release it yet. So I think, on Unico, and Unico to that matter, if it's not a right vintage for it, they won't make it. So Unico production, they put out 98, 99, 2000. They didn't make an 01. So if you see any 01 Valbuena, that's a super special bottle.
Oh, yeah, declassed.
And then from there, they released 2, 3, 4, 7, 8, 6, and then they'll be coming out with 09 this year.
That's cool. And I mean, in terms of the price, yeah, this one is elevated. But if you think of this in terms of the pricing scale of other wines of the world and great wines of the world, you're talking this is on par with basically the quality of a first growth Bordeaux, and this is its second wine. And most of those would still come higher price tags than this does. So in terms of someone who's collecting or buying wine for a special occasion, this is still considered quite a value.
And for me, I love to try to think of Valbuena as a value because comparative to Unico, you know, we can be looking at 300 to 400 or more per bottle. Unico Reserva, you know, is upwards of 400 to 500. And the wine just speaks to me in its style, its taste, its texture, the aromatics, but also its ageability. This is 09, so this was released 5 years ago, and it's still got a long life ahead of it. Valbuena easily can go 10, 20, 30 years after release. So after that initial 5 years of age, you can get up to 30 years. And Unico Reserva, even more so, you can frequently drink them on release, but you can go 40 to 60 years after release.
Am I wrong for thinking this wine kind of smells like a fortified wine? It's got this kind of port character to it.
I think that's a lot to do with the oxidative aging.
Yeah, the fact that it sees 5 years of age.
Wow, yeah, it's gorgeous. This is really cool wine, and it's soft and it's layered, and I can keep smelling this for another 2 hours, and I'm going to find something new every time I go back to the glass.
And that's why it costs 150 bones.
Oh,
the great thing about this one is it's like that every time. Every vintage I've had of Valbuena over-delivers like this.
Awesome. Yeah, what an awesome wine.
That's fantastic. Thanks.
Thanks for bringing the good juice. Closing Happy thoughts to. On Ribera del Duero and Rueda. If you are into Sauvignon Blanc, you're going to love Rueda. If you're into Chardonnay, you're probably going to love a different Rueda. If you love California Cabernet, you're going to love a Ribera del Duero. If you love Bordeaux, you're probably going to love a different kind of Ribera del Duero.
If you
like Italian wine, you probably just drink Italian wine.
And you talk too much with your hands.
Yeah, right. Folks, that brings us to the Q&A portion of Barrel to Bottle, the Binnie's podcast, where we answer your question for a $20 Binnie's gift card. Email your questions to comments@binnies.com or hit us up on social media on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter @BinniesBev. Our question this week comes from Tina. She actually dropped it off at the Barrel to Bottle booth at the Expo.
What's up, Tina?
Wine Expo. Her question is, why are wine prices so varied? What makes a $20 bottle compared to $1,000?
That's a really good question.
I mean, we could do an entire podcast about this question, right? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. I think a lot of it starts in the vineyard, you know.
Like literally the land.
The land for sure, you know. Vineyard acreage is expensive real estate. And then beyond that, you're also looking at how much attention are you giving to the vine. I remember my first work wine trip was to Washington. We went to this Cabernet farm and we're walking down this dirt road. And if you look at the left side, the vines are very manicured. The canopy was super managed, and like you could tell that they had gone through, done a few passes. There was fruit on the ground that had been dropped. And then you look to the right side and it was grown over, wild. You couldn't see the fruit because there were so many leaves. And so that right there was a great image that I'll never forget, because the people that are buying the fruit from the left side of this road are paying much more to have that vine cultivated and managed. Whereas the other guys are like, get what you can out of it, and we'll see what happens. And sure enough, the wines that were on that left side of the road were going into a $40 bottle of wine, right, hopefully, and the stuff on the right side was going into a $5 bottle.
Yeah. So the land, the labor costs, automation can save money. Sometimes it can cost money because, you know, something like an optical sorter is going to be really expensive. Then there's literally the glass, the marketing that goes into it.
Yeah, and let's not overlook the cost of oak barrels. It is excruciating how much those things cost for, you know, Pat, you can speak to that too. Just one barrel at a time, and most wineries have a rotation of 40 to 50 to hundreds of barrels at any given time. That's a very big cost, and a lot of those production kind of things are overlooked in wineries, but I agree that it's really going to start with real estate, and that also includes the facility, tasting room, tank, everything else that goes into it.
And because they can.
And then there's just the argument of what you pay for luxury items. And that's true of anything out there, whether it's a purse or a vehicle or a laptop computer. Some wines are luxury items and some wines are for everyday consumption. And yeah, we could do a whole 2 hour long podcast on why things cost money.
Tina, thanks for the question. $20 Binnie's gift card coming to you. Once again, everybody else can write their questions to us, comments@binnies.com. Hit us up on social media, @BinniesBev on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And if we answer your question on the air, we will give you a $20 Binnie's gift card. John, thanks for hanging out with us today and sharing these excellent wines.
Oh, it was a blast. Love to do it again sometime.
We'll be back in your feed in another week with another great episode of Barrel to Bottle, the Binnie's podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Greg.
I'm Barb.
I'm Pat.
I'm John. Keep tasting.
is powerful.